Welcome to Historically St. Pete, a weekly conversation where we explore the truths and possibly the myths of the people and events that created the Sunshine City. Thanks for tuning in today. My name is Rui Frias, and I have the coolest job in town. I'm the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. The Museum of History has been sharing the stories of the Sunshine City for 102 years, and we're so happy to be able to share those stories with you here today on Radio St. Pete. For about 180 years, baseball has been played on fields and diamonds throughout the United States. But like most of America, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it faced the evils of segregation and Jim Crow. The history of segregated baseball is something Major League Baseball has been struggled with and still struggles with today. To share the history of this era of baseball is our guest, Jay Caldwell. Jay is an author, collector, and protector of the history of the Baseball Negro Leagues. Welcome, Jay. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate being here.
So can you tell us, in the early days we saw some, in the early days of baseball, so we're talking, Civil War era, there were some mixed teams, but really when and where did the Negro Leagues actually start?
Well, the official Negro League started in 1920. The organizational meeting for the National Negro League took place on February 13th, 1920, at the Paseo YMCA in Kansas City, Missouri. And from that, the first 8-team league was formed, all with teams in the Midwest.
So did, there's always been discussion of, the monopoly rights that Major League Baseball has on the sport of professional baseball in the United States. So did they own the Negro League teams?
They did not. In fact, they shunned the Negro League teams. Major League Baseball didn't have a monopoly back in the 1920s. In fact, the minor league teams were not affiliated with Major League teams at that point. They could sell their players to whomever they wanted. In addition, you have something like the Pacific Coast League, which was an 8-team league in, from California to Washington State, that many people consider the equivalent of the major leagues, but they had no affiliation either.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good to know. And when the league started, I mean, I just mentioned this a few minutes ago, there were teams prior to the league starting. Didn't black and white players play together on some of the same teams?
They did. There were some integrated teams, semi-pro primarily, town teams. And then beginning in roughly 1902 or 3, you'd start seeing a lot of exhibition games played between white teams and black teams. The white teams would have a mixture of major league players, minor league players, local town residents, but they played together quite often.
And I would imagine, I mean, looking at the Tampa Bay area, I mean, Tampa was always a more their racial balance was more mixed than St. Petersburg's, right? With the number of ethnic groups that entered Tampa, like the Cuban population that came to work for the cigar factories and those type of things. So, correct. When you look at the Tampa Bay area, I mean, were there those mixed race teams prior to Negro League baseball here?
Oh yes, there were, and there were a lot of games played in this area. There weren't official Negro League teams because they didn't exist in the Deep South. Negro League players would come here for spring training. They would travel to Cuba, and on their way back, they would play. There was a famous Florida Grapefruit League that played primarily in the Miami area as entertainment for some of the major hotels. But there was a lot of baseball going on in Florida.
So MLB teams come to Florida to train, and the Negro League teams would travel to Cuba to train.
They would travel to Cuba. Another popular place for the Negro League teams was Arkansas. They would get their spring training in where they could. Another fact about Negro League teams is because they were denied access to city-owned fields in most cases in the South, and you certainly couldn't do spring training in Vermont, they would play on historical black university and college campuses. And actually, the percentage of Negro Leagues players who had a college education is believed to be higher than the white major leagues at the time, largely because that is where they played, on these college campuses, and they'd pick up some of the best players and they'd work them into the lineup.
How far, you mentioned that they did not play in the South. So how far geographically in the United States South did the teams play?
Well, they would play in the South for some spring training. Like the Monarchs would train in Louisiana. But, in terms of leagues, you have the Birmingham Black Barons in Alabama. You had the Atlanta Black Crackers in Atlanta. You had the Memphis Red Sox. But Missouri was kind of the delineation point for both the white and black leagues. Once you get beyond that, it was pretty rare.
So, the history of the Negro Leagues is talked about often when you talk about, especially around Jackie Robinson Day in the history of baseball. Can you describe what it would have been like to be a Negro League player? I mean, how much money did these guys make? I mean, what was their lives like playing in this league?
Well, they played baseball constantly. Most of them played year-round. Not all of them. But most of them played year-round, and, they would say they played, 250 to 300 games a year. Now, league play, depending on the league and the year, would be maybe 65 to 80 games. The rest of it would be exhibition games, barnstorming games, winter games in Cuba or Panama or the Dominican Republic. But they were playing year-round. Their salaries were good for black citizens of the U.S., but they weren't comparable to what the white major leaguers made.
Any idea what comparing them?
I've seen estimates of about 20%.
Oh, wow. Okay. So when you look at players, I mean, obviously, some of the most famous players, it's like Satchel Paige or Josh Gibson, these guys. How would they done if they spent their entire careers playing in Major League Baseball? How do you think they would have done?
Well, I think, the two players you mentioned, Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, would have been considered top-tier Hall of Famers regardless, and probably been better accepted if they were able to play in integrated leagues. I think of all the players that are in the Hall of Fame that came from the Negro Leagues, all of them would have had Hall of Fame careers if they played in integrated baseball. But ones like Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell clearly would have been at the very elite level.
And obviously there were a few celebrities that played and a few Major League Baseball players that, became Hall of Famers that people don't realize played, in the Negro Leagues. So talk a little bit about them, folks like, Charlie Pride and the other players.
Well, yeah, Charlie Pride actually got a start in the Negro Leagues playing for the Memphis Red Sox. And as I recall, he was a pitcher, but he made it as a country and western music star. Baseball players that we're very familiar with that most people don't realize started in the Negro Leagues would include people like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Elston Howard. Another thing that I think people don't realize is the Negro Leagues inspired a lot of people to strive for the top levels of their profession. And the Negro Leagues had deep and abiding friendships with the big band eras of the time, and they followed the same circuit. So the Negro League circuit was the same as the music circuit that the big band eras played. And so the big band teams like Cab Calloway and Dizzy Gillespie and Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, all had their own baseball teams that they'd play each other. They weren't Negro League professional Negro League capable, but it was something they did. And they would attend the Negro League's games, and at the end of the games, the Negro League players would go to the music clubs and listen to these guys play. And one of my favorite stories along those lines is Dizzy Gillespie, who was a famous trumpeter, joined Duke Ellington's band, and one of the band members said, "Well, what do you play?" Duke said, "Well, trumpet, you know that." No, I mean, what do you play? Oh, second base.
Of course. had to be second base. So socially, I mean, you touched on this a little bit, the examples they set by being at the pinnacle of their profession. How do you think this affected the African American communities in general? The folks that used to come out and watch them. play?
Well, it was definitely a source of pride. The Negro Leagues were generally considered the biggest or the second biggest employer in all the cities in which they operated in. And there was a sense of pride when, not only when they played each other, but when they played the white teams or the town teams or the barnstorming. One good thing about sports of all kinds is it's a meritocracy. And so you can see who's good, who's bad. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And you could see that these players were good players, that they deserved major league opportunities.
Did the teams in the Negro League ever play Major League Baseball teams in exhibitions?
In Cuba, there were some that were played, but generally in the U.S., it wasn't allowed. So Kennessee Mountain Landis banned Major League players from playing Negro League teams while wearing Major League uniforms. So what you'd typically find is at the end of the season, you know, you'd have somebody like Babe Ruth or Lou Gehrig lead an exhibition team that would be a mixture of major leaguers and minor leaguers, but they couldn't wear the Yankees uniform or the Cleveland Indians uniform or any other major league uniform.
What do you know his reasoning behind that, why he wouldn't allow it?
The reasoning was he didn't want him to get beat.
makes complete sense. So the Negro Leagues made the news again this summer. Can you explain what has happened with MLB now accepting or looking at the Negro League statistics?
Well, it really started in December of 2020, when Major League Baseball recognized the Negro Leagues as major leagues. The issue that came from that was how do you integrate the statistics? And it took a committee several years to kind of figure out a practical way to do it. We have, box scores of most of the games, not all of them, but they had to determine what was going to be considered a major league equivalent game. So, if Josh Gibson and the Homestead Grays played U.S. Steel's, plant number 9 team, that wouldn't be considered a major league game. Okay. But when they played the Cuban East All-Stars or if they played the Brooklyn Royal Giants, that was considered a major league game.
So how are they – what was the result? What are they doing with the stats? I mean, do the home run kings of MLB remain? Or is there now a player that has surpassed some of them?
Well, in terms of cumulative statistics, the white major leagues primarily dominate because they simply didn't play enough games to do cumulative statistics. But on a percentage basis, for instance, batting average, slugging average, on-base percentage, there are Negro League players who did better, are now considered the leaders or top of the leaderboards on a percentage basis because it was measured based on the traditional statistics and, percentage doesn't really matter how many games you played.
So when, when Jackie Robinson, breaks the color barrier with the Dodgers, why did the Negro Leagues continue? Why did it continue so long?
Well, I think there are three reasons, really. Probably first was that not all major league teams integrated right away. The last one to integrate was the Boston Red Sox in 1959, and so it was a slow evolution. Second, because the Negro Leagues were major employers in all the cities, there was a big base of businesses that were dependent on the Negro Leagues. You can think of just the ushers and the vendors at the ball game. But taxi cabs, restaurants, hotels, auto repair shops, barber shops, they were all dependent on this black trade that was necessary, and that held it back. I think those are probably the major reasons for why it took a while. The Negro League's last real formal schedule was 1960, and they continued as exhibition games up until the late 60s, 67, 68, But there weren't published schedules after 1960.
I mean, did Major League Baseball ever consider looking at some of these teams? You know, obviously, they were signing, right, the most talented, what they thought were the most talented players.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever think of looking at some of these teams as possible, you know, minor league affiliates?
Not that I'm aware of. There were efforts, though, to do that. For instance, Rube Foster, who is the founder of the Negro National League, proposed back in 1919, that Major League Baseball should bring in two all-black teams to integrate. His basis for doing that was he had experience playing in the California Winter League, which was an integrated league of segregated teams. So there was a couple white teams, there was a Mexican team, and there would be a black team. And he thought that would work for Major League Baseball. He thought the opportunity would come because of the depletion of Major League talent, first with the formation of the Federal League, then with World War I, and then with the flu pandemic. All of which drained Major League rosters.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than look to the Negro Leagues, they pulled players from the high minor leagues.
Gotcha. So I know that you know, we look back at the history of baseball on St. Pete's waterfront, and we looked at attendance figures, for instance, and we know that you know, everybody, you know, would imagine that when Babe Ruth was here, those were the games that were, you know, highest in attendance. But in actuality, the games that Jackie Robinson actually played in Al Lang owned the attendance records for Al Lang or for Waterfront Field. Did the Major League Baseball teams, did they see attendance hikes as they started signing these Negro League players?
Definitely. In 1947, the single game attendance record for every National League team except the Cincinnati Reds came when Jackie Robinson was playing. So definitely expanded attendance. The estimates are that when he first arrived in Brooklyn to play, half the seats were sold to black fans.
Fantastic. What about the Negro Leagues do you think that we don't know? Is there something that's been the secret or an untold story that people should know about these leagues?
Good question. You know, I guess it really depends on your level of knowledge. There's so many great anecdotes about the Negro Leagues and how they played, the, you know, the barnstorming. You know, one of the stories I've always been fascinated about is when Satchel Paige led a bunch of players to the Dominican Republic to play in what was a summer league. It caused the collapse of the Pittsburgh Crawfords, which had been one of the greatest teams, because Pittsburgh Crawfords, including pretty much the entire starting lineup, went to the Dominican Republic to play with Paige because they got better pay.
Yeah.
There are stories like that that probably aren't really well known. And another aspect, I guess, was some innovations that occurred in the Negro Leagues. Night baseball started in the Negro Leagues. The owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, J.L. Wilkinson, invented a portable lighting system so his team could play deep into the night, because barnstorming was very valuable to them. And that was the start of night baseball. The first batting helmet was in the Negro Leagues as a result of Willie Wells being hit by a pitch ball in the head. He came back, I think it was 2 days later, wearing a modified construction helmet.
Oh, wow.
But there are other innovations of that type that really came out of the Negro Leagues.
So how do you, and I'm going to share with the audience, I mean, you have an amazing collection of art of Negro League players that we had on exhibit at the Museum of History, and hopefully will soon again. How did your interest in this begin?
When I retired from my career, I was still looking to do something and was trying to think what I could do. And I grew up around Cooperstown, so I was very interested in baseball. And my children always made fun of me of leading a black and white life, because I always watched Gunsmoke and the Maltese Falcon and other movies in black and white. And so I thought, what aspect of baseball is really only covered in black and white photography. And I came up with the Negro Leagues because they largely played before color photography, but even with color photography, nobody colored, they didn't cover the Negro Leagues. The white papers didn't. So they kind of inspired me, and then I started looking for artists who would paint Negro League portraits. And we did that in preparation for the centennial of the founding of the Negro Leagues in 2020.
And those portraits have turned into cards now.
They've turned into cards. They're part of a traveling exhibit. I just did another one this year, just released the set in July. New artist, all original artwork for the 1924 Negro Leagues World Series, which is the first Negro Leagues World Series. Again, centennial celebration.
Fantastic. Jay, thank you so much for joining us today on Historically St. Pete and sharing this, sometimes uncomfortable but amazing history with us. I'm inviting our listeners to tune in weekly to RadioSt.Pete.com for our Historically St. Pete podcast and stop by the Museum of History on your next visit to the St. Pete Pier and explore the rich and unique history of the Sunshine City, including Schrader's Little Cooperstown exhibit, which is the world's largest collection of autographed baseballs. And we do have a Negro League section in that exhibit, along with a number of other Hall of Famers. So if you're a baseball fan or want to learn about baseball, you need to see that exhibit. Visit historystpete.org for more details on our exhibits, our new historic trolley, Segway, and boat tours. Thank you very much for listening. Join us next week on Historically St. Pete.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.